नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय नारायणं नमस्कृत्यं नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जया मुदीरये नष्टप्रायेषु अभद्रेषु नित्यं भागवत सेवया भगवती उत्तम श्लोके भक्तिर्भवति नैष्ठिकी. So we are reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 3, chapter entitled Liberation from the Illusory Energy. Text 14, 15 and 16. So text 14. Please repeat after me. Ritarupam tu tamasa Vayo jyoti praliyate Ritasparsho vakasena Vayu nabasi liyate Kalatmana rita gunam Nava atmani liyate Rita rupam tu tamasa Vayo jyoti praliyate Rita sparsho vakashena Vayu nabasi liyate Kalatmana rita gunam Nava atmani liyate Rita rupam tu tamasa Vayo jyoti praliyate Rita sparsho vakashena Vayu nabashi liyate Kalatmana rita gunam Nava atmani liyate. Rupam tu tamasa Vayu jyoti kaliyate Asparsho vakasena Vayu nabasi liyate Kalatmana rita gunam Nava atmani liyate Rita rupam tu tamasa Vayu jyoti praliyate Rita sparsho vakashena Vayu nabasi liyate Kalatmana rita gunam Nava atmani liyate Sparsho Vayu nabasi liyate Kalatmana rita gunam Nava atmani liyate Matajis Rita rupam tu tamasa Vayu jyoti praliyate Rita sparsho vakashena Vayu sparsho siliyate Atmana rita rupam Nava atmani liyate Rita rupam, deprived of its quality of form. Tu, certainly. Tamasa, by darkness. Vayo, into air. Jyoti, fire. Praliyate, merges. Rita sparsha, deprived of touch. Avakashena, by the element space. Vayu, air. Nabhasi, into space. Liyate, merges. Kala Atmana, by the Supreme Soul in the form of time. Ritagunam, deprived of its tangible quality. Nabha, space. Atmani, into false ego, in the mode of ignorance. Liyate, merges. Translation: fire, deprived of its form by darkness, dissolves into the element air. When the air loses its quality of touch by the influence of space, the air merges into that space. When space is deprived of its tangible quality by the Supreme Soul in the form of time, space merges into false ego in the mode of ignorance. There's no purport, so text 15. Translation by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. My dear king, the material senses and intelligence merge into false ego in the mode of passion from which they arose. And the mind, along with the demigods, merges into false ego in the mode of goodness. Then the total false ego, along with all of its qualities, merges into the Mahatattva. Text 16, translation and purport by disciples of Srila Prabhupada. Translation: I have now described Maya, the illusory energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This illusory potency, consisting of the three modes of material nature, is empowered by the Lord for the creation, maintenance and annihilation of the material universe. Now, what more do you wish to hear? Purport: King Nimi had expressed to the Navayogendras his fear of the illusory potency of the Lord and had requested a detailed explanation of Maya so that he could avoid becoming a victim at her hands. Now Sri Antariksha, having described the illusory potency, is suggesting that the king inquire about the means to become totally free of Maya's influence. Not waiting for the king to ask such a question, Sri Antariksha himself is suggesting, now that you have heard about Maya's influence, you should inquire about the process of becoming free of such influence. According to Srila Swami, that is the significance of Sri Antariksha's question, Kim Bhuya Shrotam Ichasi, what more do you wish to hear? The following is a summary of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur's explanation of the process of annihilation described in the previous verses. Vasudev, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is the presiding deity of consciousness which becomes manifest within the Mahatattvas. By further transformations of the Mahatattva, the threefold false ego appears as follows. One, from Vaikarika, false ego in the mode of goodness, appears the 11th sense, the mind, whose presiding deity is Aniruddha. Two, from Tejasa, false ego in the mode of passion, comes intelligence, whose presiding deity is Pradyumna, and the five working senses and five knowledge acquiring senses with their various presiding deities. Three, from false ego in the mode of ignorance arises the subtle form of sound, and from the sound or Shabda, all the material elements gradually become manifest, beginning with ether and the sense of hearing. The presiding deity of all of these three divisions of false ego is Shankarshan. This description is taken from chapter 26 of the third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, verses 21, 27, 28, 30, 31, 32 and 35. The Supreme Personality of Godhead's external potency, Maya, causes the birth, maintenance and destruction of the material world. She is tricolored, red, white and black. In her red feature, the material nature is created, in white it endures, and in black it is annihilated. The Mahatattva arises from this Maya, And from the Mahatattva comes the three varieties of false ego mentioned above. At the time of annihilation, the five great elements, namely earth, water, fire, air and ether, merge into false ego in the mode of ignorance, from which they were originally generated. The ten senses and intelligence merge into false ego and passion, and the mind along with the demigods merges into false ego in the mode of goodness, which then merges into Mahatattva, which further takes shelter of the Prakriti or unmanifest Pradhan. As described above, each of the gross elements is wound up when its distinguishing quality is removed. The element then merges into the previous element. This can be understood as follows. In space or ether, there is a quality of sound. In air, there are the qualities of sound and touch. In fire, there are sound, touch and form. In water, there are sound, touch, form and taste. And in earth, there are sound, touch, form, taste and aroma. Therefore, from ether down to earth, such each element is distinguished by the addition of its own unique quality called guna vishesham. When that quality is removed, an element becomes non-different from its previous element and thus merges into it. For example, when great winds take aroma away from earth, earth contains only sound, touch, form and taste and thus becomes non-different from water into which it merges. Similarly, when water loses its rasa or taste, it contains only sound, touch and form, thus becoming non-different from fire, which also contains those three qualities. So the wind takes away aroma to merge earth into water and takes away taste to merge water into fire. Then when the universal darkness removes form from fire, fire merges into air. Space then removes the sense of touch from air, and air merges into space. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, as a time element, removes sound from space, and space then merges into the false ego in the mode of ignorance, from which it arose. Finally, false ego is merged into the Mahatattva, which is merged into the unmanifest Pradhana, and thus the universe is annihilated. Om Agyan Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakhaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Mano Bhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadhati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Gurum Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamsa Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunathanvitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhanvitamscha Om Krishna Prakaruna Sindhu Dinabandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Sute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vishubhano Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Panchakalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhuva Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prastaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Tinamine Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Pashyata Deshatarine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shiva Sadi Gaura Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So we are into a very high technical subject of how the process of annihilation takes place. So I will not go into that. Those who are interested in that can, certainly we have many great scholars here. But the essence of what the disciples of Srila Prabhupada have mentioned in the purport is that no matter how the merging of each of the elements take place, the basic is that we understand that our five senses, gross senses and three, eight senses, but from the gross to the most subtle, the mind, for intelligence and false ego are the three which are much more subtle than the five grosser senses. And the fact that the false ego goes beyond even our intelligence is really a very important aspect that we generally don't grasp, because we really, in the way the world is created, we consider intelligence to be the most. The way the structure of the whole system in the last few centuries has gone by, that we don't realize that the basic cause of all bondage basically is actually a false ego. So this is really one of the critical elements we understand from when we come in touch with spiritual knowledge, that the distinguishing feature is that that there is an element which is perhaps the cause of all bondage actually, and where the sources of all the of all our problems come. Really, if you go to the root, is the non-understanding of the false ego. And again, the understanding of that that is why Srila Prabhupada would always emphasize on the basics constantly, in the beginning as well as in the end. I mean, right through his 12 years that he created ISKCON and preached all over the world. And he kept hammering this one point that we are not this body, that I'm the problem. When he defined false ego, is that everything stems from the feeling that I am the doer, I am the controller, I am the master, and basically by definition I am the enjoyer. And the truth is that actually Krishna is the ultimate enjoyer. And this we mentally kind of get used to hearing this over and over again, that we are not this body, we are not this body, and that's the source of the problem when we think identifying with the body. But actually what really comes out is that this truth, which that Krishna is the ultimate enjoyer, we mentally agree, but actually that is the greatest opposition to the way the world is around us is created, and the way we have accepted it. In a sense, the way we get brainwashed into thinking that, so therefore that is the single biggest obstacle to our false ego. Just the fact that we are not able to understand first or even accept that Krishna is the ultimate enjoyer. So the process of Krishna consciousness, spiritual life, in very simple words, is really the consciousness to understand that we are ultimately, whatever we do, and whatever we do means anything we do, no matter which part of the world we are in, what background we come from, whatever profession we take, whatever our, you know, status of life is, these are axiomatic truths, that they never change, that we have come and we will be going, and our purpose is to understand what is the root. And if the root is that, why is it we consider that our identification in the body and all its elements, when we say body means, it means all the other subtler elements which encourage our thinking of the body, why is that the most challenging? Because it takes us further away from the reality, which is really Krishna who is the controller. And the proof of it is really, we see that when we have come into contact with an organization like ISKCON or with devotees, It has been a radical change in our understanding for most people. So it means that our beliefs that we had, or let's say we had some incomplete understandings, or we had completely different understandings, has undergone a substantial change. So we can see it ourselves. Even after coming to contact with devotees, we may spend years and we become completely fully convinced that this is the truth. But nobody, well, I wouldn't say nobody, but most of us wouldn't really have a steady, continuous growth in, in Krishna consciousness. There will be times when we completely, when we are actually, we may not realize it, but we are caught up in so many other aspects of our life. If we are successful in some things and we get so excited and we are moving towards it, if we are, and then slowly this becomes a little bit a mental acceptance, and then slowly becomes like a one part of the corner of the room of our mind. Or if we have had severe failures and we are so caught up in the anxieties, then our understanding at that time would be, if at all, we would be looking to solutions that my immediate solution should be, well, I'm coming to a temple, I'm a devotee, why am I getting this problem? So which means we are immediately falling into that trap of slowly moving away from Krishna. So even after coming in touch with devotees, we can see that this could be a genuine challenge. So that is why this is considered that this greatest threat or the opposition to the ultimate reality, that is Krishna and Krishna's devotees and his paraphernalia, is this mentality which is prevalent everywhere. And if you go to see a clear proof of it, is that whatever problems we have in around us, if you take on a world level, whether we say that crime is a problem, or there are wars or terrorism, or there is, and that causes hatred, envy. But if you see, take crime, when we say there is a crime, means there is a criminal, right? That some person is identified as a criminal. And then if it's a big crime or it's a famous personality involved, then it's all news everywhere. Or if it is a small crime, relatively speaking, or unknown person, then it is somewhere somebody catches it. But immediately our thought is that this person is dubbed a criminal. So there are social norms, social laws, and they have validity, and according to that a person is considered a criminal. But really speaking, it's a subjective view, because the criminal, yes, according to the norms, he may have done a robbery. But if you go to his family, or his dear ones, or near ones, or people who knew him well, perhaps you may get, they have a different view, that he has been driven to it by society. He has been pushed into that. Landlords have come and, harassed him, and he is now without any land or without any money, and, he's practically on the streets, so he had to do it for survival. There could be any stories. We don't know that. So, ultimately, the point is that it is a subjective view. There is a criminal, but then somebody is a victim. So who's a criminal, who's a victim? If we actually get affected by it, then if someone near us, then we know that person's story, we look at it that way. Similarly, in terrorism also, immediately there is a definition which has come. Probably 30 years ago that word was never used. 40 years ago, at least most of you may not have, but I never heard of it till in our youth. It is only in the last 30-40 years. Now, we now understand that terrorism means there are people who have caused hatred and they are moving only towards it. But in his country, or maybe in his community or people who back him, he is considered a martyr, or he is considered a victim. That he is someone who has been, he has seen some, he has been highly affected by brutality and so on, and he has been driven to it. We don't know that. So again, there are two views. So there will always be a relative. These are all relative perceptions, relative truths. If you take any violence or wars also, war that is, if you are in this country, you will be naturally thinking that the other country is the enemy. And if you are in that country, you will think that the other country is the enemy. So, ultimately, unless we take the standard of Krishna, the standard of the scriptures, or the standard of the sadhus, we will always be looking at a subjective view about any problem in life.
So this is where the pole star for us is that the barometer for comparisons, how do we look at it from the perspective of Krishna? And irrespective of what we have thought in the past, we accept it as the truth. It's not that we have any vested interests, because till we actually knew the reality, we were in ignorance. Now that we know, it is our duty to try and see that how we can mold our life to moving towards it in such a way with guidance. And that is where the issue of association comes, the issue of accepting a guru comes, or before that we have a mentor, people whom we take advice from. All this comes in. And the more aware we are, the more grateful we'll be that nothing happens by accident. And because nothing happens by accident, which means though we've had a problem and we've been driven here, but because of the problem we have come in contact with reality, which many people have not got. So it's a big step forward. And having come in contact with reality, we are also being given the door, the key to the door of the solution, of the answer. It's not easy, but it's a step by step, and people are there, well-meaning people who are there for with us all the way. Which again is something which, how many people can say this in the world, that we cannot control the miseries and challenges, but how many people can say that while going through it, even if we accept that, then there are, we have, at least in our case, in our congregation, we would have hundreds of people, if not more, who are, you know, supporting, praying, helping in any way, going out of the way. So which means that this is a lifeline which has been thrown, and it is also done by Krishna. So Krishna has arranged the whole situation such a way that if you have accepted one step towards Him, then His method of taking us back to Him is His own. He has His own unique way, and we should not try to put our thinking and our expression that this is the way He should take us back. So therefore He, that lifeline is also, it comes in a very disguised form. We don't see it as a lifeline initially, we only see it as pain and frustration and so on. But in that pain and frustration, slowly if we stick to the process and we stick to the due sadhana process, and then slowly things dawn. Just like a child at the age of 2, there is a limited understanding, very limited. Then at the age of 5, there is some more understanding. At the age of 10, the child is far more aware. And then in the youth, they are much more aware. So it takes time. Similarly here, our mental consciousness is also like a child, a spiritual consciousness. The contact and the, from the time we have a contact to the time we really understand how we can link it to our lifestyle, it's a whole process. It can be a lifetime, it can be more. So rather than judging or fighting what the situation is, yes, we should be looking for solutions. But that doesn't mean, when we say fight, means we will definitely use our intelligence to see what Krishna has in store for us. Perhaps we have a solution which is the way we understand it. Perhaps we don't have a solution the way we understand it. But either way, we look at it. So that is why we say that when we look at problems, we should be seeing it and that these problems are really ultimately because of the perception that it's not connected to Krishna. So when we look at crime, wars, violence, hatred, envy, on a bigger scale, national scale, personal level, whatever levels, we see that this is primarily derived because of the causes of it. It's not a matter of religion being causing it, it's a matter of individuals. And these individuals and the leadership and the consciousness of the leadership, which really creates a situation accordingly. So this mentality actually is, we see from scriptures also that this mentality of, or this false ego thinking is, we hear this in constantly stories. So many stories bring this out that it is not just a black and white thing. You know, like for instance, Indra for instance. Indra is the king of heavens and he is a great personality. And yet, quite often we hear him, several stories involve him where he gets temporarily caught out in certain thinking where he forgets that Krishna is the ultimate reality, and then he thinks his own position is so strong And then eventually he comes back down to earth, and his greatness that he accepts his humiliation. You know, his humiliation is therefore, we are not historical figures. Even if a prime minister or a president, you know, nobody bothers about a president 200 years later. Today, who's worried about something happened, somebody did it in the year 1750 or 1800. So it may be lasting 100 years, 200 years. But Indra, for eternity, billions of people will read about him, and you know, he's accepted his humiliation in the Govardhan Leela, for instance, how he acted in such a way, and he was actually trying to kill devotees and kill Krishna, and then he had to accept it, he had to swallow his pride, and he went to Brahma. Brahma guided him to Surbhi cow, and then through Surbhi she approached on his behalf. So he willingly accepted. So we saw both sides of it, that how the false ego can cover up everything temporarily. Nobody is exempt from it. And at the same time, if we really take the pain, and the humiliation is a very painful thing, very, very painful. I mean, we can't even imagine what he must have gone through. That kind of humility, but then that also shows his level of attachment to Krishna in the reality, that he actually accepted it fully and totally surrendered without any mincing any words. So this is only one incident, and we see this often coming in where people they're temporarily covered up. In the case of Gajendra, for instance, also very great personality, the king of elephants, everybody was respecting him, he had a large number of fans, a large number of family, everything. But when he got caught up in with the alligator, and then he fought for thousands of years, and he was losing that battle, so he was using all his strength, which means he was initially concentrating only on his power, which was immense, thinking that he is the controller and doer. But eventually, in the worst of his times, when his life was ebbing, he turned towards Vishnu, and Vishnu blessed him. So, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also, in the matter of Keshav Kashmiri, that was one of the greatest debaters and philosophers of his time, and he was so caught up in his glories, Keshav Kashmiri, that he was thinking, he was the greatest debater, he could defeat anyone, there was nobody who came in his presence who could stand by his, but then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu totally flattened him, and then he converted and became one of a great devotee, a follower of Lord Chaitanya. So there are two ways we can approach it. We could either take it that we confront it, and then we manifest our worst in us and continue to oppose Krishna and whatever in today's world we may see Krishna in so many forms, it is in devotees and temples, and we may oppose it tooth and nail because of our hatred, or we may accept it and take it as a grateful that it's a lesson that we learned, and we come back, move towards Krishna. But it brings a very interesting point when we are talking of Indra and Gajendra and others. So it's another thought that we sometimes get caught up in thinking. When we are hearing the stories, at least I am seeing from my recollection, that right from childhood when you hear stories about Ramayana and Mahabharata and so on, so you form a picture of the good and the bad. And also in movies, you always have a good and the bad, and eventually good wins. So there is a black and white concept. So you think that the demons are certain way, you know, and you have descriptions told, and your grandmother or grandfather would have told you in some graphic way. So you start thinking that they look like a monster, they look like something definitely not like us, and so they're physically different, they're different species, and therefore that's the bad, and we are the victim, but we are not like that. And then there was a very nice article which came in the Back to Godhead many years ago by His Holiness Jayadvait Maharaj. It mentioned who is a demon. I remember reading that, and which is very interesting, because the reality is that the demon could be so-called very cultured, the demon could be suited, booted, the demon could be us, could be a devotee. So it is the demon, so it is not the physical appearance, it is the behavior, it is the attitude, it is not even that because we picked up the chanting beads, we have now been certified that we got a stamp that now you are completely out of it. No, so actually we could regress into it. Like how we see in the case of Indra, that he has it often, that he falls into that trap and then he comes out of it. So even Lord Brahma also had, Brahma Vibhavan Leela also we see that how he, who is the creator, has actually been completely covered. And this is Krishna's Leela to show, to give this, drive the same point. So we have to be very cautious to know that when we look at Shastras and when we start defining, we may tend to feel that since we have entered an exclusive club or an elitist club of exalted personalities, and we do see many exalted personalities around us, and that is, it is a fact that we see people who are extremely renounced, extremely humble, very dedicated, only after 10, 20, 30 years, they're only Krishna consciousness their life, they're only willing to help people, whoever it is. When we see that, we slowly start blurring the lines between, we start kind of thinking that we are so close and they allow us to be close to them. So through that we think that we are also, well, we may not consciously think that we are like them, but we think we are quite close to them, that okay, we have a few errors and mistakes we make, but we are almost like them. And therefore we start thinking that we are, this false ego concept of misidentifying, is the last thing in our mind, because we are already here, we are physically in this temple, we are 20 feet, 50 feet away from, in fact we are in the lap of Prabhupada and Radha Gopinath physically, so we think that we are completely protected, whatever our behavior, whatever our thinking, whatever attitude. So we go out, and then in our lives, we have, or even if we are staying here, our thoughts and our mind, as we said, the false ego is subtler than even the intelligence. It can come in so many ways, so many ways. It's a constant challenge. And it is such a, such a insidious approach that we come to know much later and that we're afflicted by it. When a problem happens or when we suddenly see that we've done something which we should not have, and then we analyze and see what caused it. Could be minor, could be major. So we have to examine it, and therefore it is said that the more we have, if we are blessed, let's say, you know, today people would say that if somebody has got very good looks, a lot of wealth, a lot of very high intelligence, sharp memory, or a very good cultural family background, when we read that, when Queen Kunti, for instance, in her prayers says that these could be actually a burden. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur warned us several times that this, these actually, these so-called blessings, what we consider as progress. So we have to actually try to understand that how it can, in the light of what we discussed, that it can completely blur our thinking. And then gradually we identify with those external attributes of what we've been given and move into this, into on that path. So while we are externally in a, you can say it's like almost like autopilot, we are in a temple, we come here, you know, like almost like a robot. I won't say robot, but it's an automatic reaction. You take up the beads, you go through a chanting, you come to the temple, you may listen when Guru Maharaj comes or when personalities come, we hear them, we appreciate them. So there is one level, there's a parallel level that is our life. So if there could be, the two may not meet, hopefully it will never happen, but oftentimes it meets, but oftentimes it diverges. So this is what we need to always look at, that where is the inner track? There is the external track, which is where all our attributes, like our thinking, our, we are absorbing it. If we have a good memory, we are able to understand the shlokas, if we have got, so it is likely that the process will help us. It is almost certain that if we sincerely follow it, it will help us. But that little minute independence that we have, so it is not that it is, if we follow the process sincerely, that's all we need to check. If following it, definitely Krishna will protect us. But the anxiety we have has to be there. That means that whether we are, our inner track is actually, how do we compare with that? You know, then how is it actually, what am I thinking? How far removed I am from this, the problems that are there? Not that we are consumed by it to the extent that we are paralyzed. As I say, paralysis by analysis in corporate, you know, that people can analyze and they don't do anything, they're completely paralyzed. Not like that. But we have to constantly be vigilant, and we do get wind. That is the meaning of listening to Shastra, listening to debate, listening to when we have satsang programs, so that it is a touch with reality where we are, and we look at ourselves also and then see. We may or may not admit it, but we do know, and then we know where we have, we are facing a problem, because maybe the situation has changed a bit, and now some of the things are not in our control, but now we are into more challenging territory. And then we have to shift the gear. And we are, opposite may be true, that when we are actually in an easier territory, things are going relatively well, that's even more dangerous, because then we are less anxiety, so we feel that life is beautiful, it's blissful, nice, everything is going well, but nothing remains at the same level, you know, it can go up and down. So if you take, the concept of education as an attribute, high education may is something which is considered to be a very important. Most people in the world, almost all the families in the world of 7 billion people, will consider that we'll want a child to be highly educated. The doctorate is the highest. And prior to coming to spirituality, most people, the vast majority, would think that this Krishna consciousness means it's inferior, because all you, what will you, just chant and you pray, and what do you do? You don't make any tangible progress. You don't see any major contribution to your family, to your bank balance, to society. You know, you may be, sometimes people say, okay, I'm not only in the matter of money, but I'm, you know, for them it's important to be in the arts and culture, because in the US it's very prominent, even in Europe, that they have these philharmonic symphonies, then they have these museums. And to be controlling those institutions, or to be the head of institutions, considered very, very prestigious. So, in various forms, you feel that you have arrived, because you are, that becomes a goal. And what is the Vedic life, Vedic education definition? In the Vedic definition, it says that one who understands the science of Krishna is intelligent. So, that's all. So that means by that definition, you could be a zero for most people. We could also be if we don't really follow it. And Prabhupada, many times he said this, which was quite baffling to me when I first read it. I thought it is probably an encouraging way of saying that, where he said that the most devotees are the most intelligent people. So first I used to think that he is just encouraging ISKCON devotees, he is encouraging those who are following just for that week. There may be an element of encouragement, but he was talking the truth. What he meant is, devotees, first of all, didn't mean an organization. A devotee also doesn't mean that someone who just picks up the beat, but someone who genuinely accepts the science of Krishna and understands begins to understand the reality of where we are and what the purpose of life is. That person is the most intelligent. He has discovered a treasure which unfortunately is missing elsewhere. So then what is the purpose of all the education? So in fact, it is not that what we learnt is completely bogus. The material sciences have a value, and it can be put to great use. We have, even among spiritual organizations, we have so many people who are highly educated and putting it to great use. And conversely, in outside world, people who are not at all educated doesn't mean automatically they're spiritually inclined. They may be going to the wrong path. So it is not the education per se, but it is the mentality that actually causes thinking that we are something superior. So if we understand the Vedic life, that Vedic definition, that science of Krishna is the uppermost, absolutely the most, and everything else follows, then whatever else we do, it has meaning. I can say from my own personal example, when my wife, you know, she came from a Gujarati medium education. So when we got married almost 40 years ago, so I used to think, and that time I just started business, so when we used to have our collaborators, partners, you know, in Germany and in Holland, and I was learning German also. So I put so much emphasis on English. And I was thinking, and then for many years, in fact even after coming to ISKCON, you keep thinking that we look at education, you think that, well, English medium is something, and regional languages, you know, okay, they're doing the best, but there's always a certain gap. And it's only in the last 10-15 years it's really dawned that when I understood that actually, you know, when we, my wife and I, when she never kind of brought anything up, but slowly when we have been hearing so many Gujarati bhajans and Gujarati songs, which are, and then she would say, oh, this we learnt in school, this we learnt in school, and I was amazed that I really respected that, you know, cultural education. I mean, they had I would never think that we would ever understand so many of these wonderful bhajans about Narsingh Mehta and many others, Yamunaji and Krishna and all these, and they're so beautiful. So it's just a understanding, say, how we can get brainwashed into thinking that something is superior because we have just got a certain kind of background on education. So these are very subtle things, and we have to constantly look at and then see that we are actually blessed when we are given this opportunity. Similarly, thinking that with education we'll be happy could also be a complete mistake, because very interestingly, recently I came across an article. If you Google that also, you can just, there are many articles based on that. That there are two professors in Berkeley, which is one of the most prestigious universities in the world. So their research was on that with wealth actually reduces compassion. And these are not devotees, or they don't have a bias towards spirituality to make a point. One may say that if I were to make, or you were to make, you know, we would then say that obviously you want to project something. These are people who have nothing to do with it. In fact, they come from that part of the world. But to do a research and to present a paper means you have to follow certain methodology which is very exacting. And it has to be demonstrated, you have to have it has to be done in a very, very transparent and also very long period of time of how you go through, you have to describe the system of all the research. So I'll just quote some of the approaches they made to come to a certain hypothesis like this. One was that they went to an intersection on the road, in a busy intersection, where there were four roads going there, and then they just observed for several days and they made detailed notings. So they found that luxury car drivers were far more prominent in cutting off when the others, you know, they were that they would actually cut off the other cars to go further. They also found that same luxury car owners were more likely to when a person is crossing the zebra crossing for pedestrians, especially in the West, they have extremely disciplined approach. You know, it is a big crime that you have to stop. The pedestrian gets the pathway. But they found that from those people who generally, went ahead and blocked the pedestrian after making eye contact with the pedestrian, and they wanted the first right of movement, they found that of those who went, vast majority were luxury car owners. Then they took another survey, different, and this is, they had to document this over a lot of time. They also, they took a bunch of people and they asked the participants to just spend a few minutes thinking of who were better off than you and who were worse off than you financially, who were richer and worse. Just think mentally. And then they were given a jar of sweets. And they were told that you can take as much as you want home. Whatever is left will be given to the poor children. So they found that the wealthier people took far more rather than the others. Then they also, another experiment they did is that they made several statements, like saying that, I often think of people in need. Yeah? It's making a statement. I often think of people in need. Or that we should think, we should do something for those who are more vulnerable. And they found that the less affluent people identified with those. They said, yes, we do think of it sometimes. The more affluent people just, very few people actually accepted it. It was quite a shock. So this is in the in their society. People who have actually done this has nothing to do with spirituality. And we are hearing this all the time. We are hearing this from time immemorial. So we can understand that if we need to actually get proof, I mean, there is, you can just Google and say, does wealth reduce compassion? You will find, and this is just, there are several articles, several surveys done, and this is only one of them I'm quoting. So, and I remember one just a few years ago when the previous president in the US, Obama, when he was a Democrat, so he had actually initiated a proposal that, you know, the tax rate in the US is something like 27-28% or so. And the billionaires, they actually on an average pay only 15%. Because they have the, they are able to exploit the tax breaks that are there. Legal, may not be ethical, but legal. They will find the way, you know, they know exactly how. So they are actually paying only average of 15%. So the proposal was that they can at least, if you just add 2 or 3% more tax to them, just block some of those loopholes, then there would be, you know, the amount would be in several billions, tens of billions, which could then compensate those who are less affluent. And the uproar that was there, and this we are talking only 6-7 years ago, so I very clearly remember, I mean, it was over several months that this debate took place. It was such, except for 2-3 millionaires who actually came out and said that yes, it made sense. Only 2-3. The majority was, it was such an uproar that then they had all the powers to use the lobby, so that they, this was completely forgotten. So you can see that one would think that, okay, if you are getting a billion is 7,000 crores, 6,500 crores, and if you are actually having an income, or let's say if you are having a wealth of 50,000-60,000 crores, if you pay a few hundred crores more, it, you know, it would, one would think it would not make more difference, if, especially if it is considered equitous. But this is the, because once the mentality is that, also one other statement which was put by that in the survey, that greed is good. He said more people identify with the statement, those who are affluent, that they say greed is good. So it is an eye opener. So we can understand from this that actually so if we don't have this Vedic understanding or the philosophical understanding, then whatever we are given in future, let's not assume that today I am in difficulty, so I am in Krishna's in front of him and I am taking this process, and tomorrow something happens, my situation changes. The problem which brought me here, if that goes away, do I have the confidence that I still remain in the process? That is a question. I mean, so it has to be irrespective of that. And even among Krishna, often Krishna warns us that in devotional service, don't have expectations. Even in devotional service, you can have expectations. And if you have expectations, you can have problems. There are two opposing examples of in Prabhupada's, two Prabhupada's disciples. One was in 1968, this is hardly, you can say practically the beginning of his movement. And this devotee was an incredible devotee. You know, he was running a center, one of the earliest centers outside New York. And he made, by far, even today, I would say, probably the highest number of what you call the most important disciples of Prabhupada. He was instrumental in today, at least more than a dozen of the senior most disciples of Prabhupada have come because of him. He was that good. And I remember Jayadeva Maharaj, in his memory, talks about him. And he said he was, in debating and in philosophy, he was so good. Jayadeva Maharaj said he was terrifyingly good. Anyone would come in front of him, he would just smash them. And this was only 2 years after meeting Prabhupada. And suddenly in 68 he disappeared. He just left. So devotees were very upset and very sad that he left. And then 3 years later, in 71, he resurfaced. So they wrote to Prabhupada and that he's back and all. The Prabhupada was in India at that time, and that his devotee wrote to him, Prabhupada also, and everyone was very happy, ecstatic. And he said that, you know, I've come back and I'm willing to join and so on. So, I mean, devotees came to him and to Prabhupada. So Prabhupada was very cool. He had not met him after he left. He was in India, 10,000 miles away. And Prabhupada wrote back, okay, very happy, so on. You can come to the temple. But you will not be the president of the temple. You will be just like any other devotee, attending Mangalarti, etc., etc., and all that. And that devotee never replied and he never came back. That was the last they heard of him. So Prabhupada understood that there was a subtle pride. He was coming in as if that, you know, he came with that aura of greatness. I am coming back. I am doing something for Prabhupada. So that false ego, even among devotees, they had done so much in terms of Shastra, in terms of knowledge. But when he came back and Prabhupada sensed it in a letter. And nobody spotted it. And when he replied back, he actually welcomed him. He was polite, but he said, he made it very clear that you will be coming in as a regular devotee and so on. And that he couldn't accept. So he was right in analyzing that. So we can see that a false ego can be so subtle. And on the other hand, His Holiness Hridayanand Das Goswami Maharaj, who's one of the earliest disciples of, he himself talks about his own like that. He was in very early on, in the late 60s, he was put in charge of South America. And today he is, I think, connected to South America. So when Prabhupada first went to Venezuela or Mexico, he was with him and he was sitting in the front of the car, and Prabhupada was there with a new devotee at the back. A very new person had come. So Prabhupada was all attention, and whatever little that new person was doing, Prabhupada was encouraging him, talking to him. And Hridayanand Maharaj says that he was sitting in the front. That time he had just taken sannyasa. So he was feeling that I know so much more than this new fellow. So once that person's, so Prabhupada was, you know, like how you encourage a baby. Prabhupada was encouraging him and very, very giving personal attention, encouraging him. So as soon as that conversation stopped, and Hridayanand Maharaj turned around and started telling Prabhupada, okay, Prabhupada, we're doing this program, that program, and then I'm preaching this, and then in between he was quoting many slokas. Because Hridayanand Maharaj is a brilliant orator, and he was speaking so many shlokas, and that too in the first 3-4 years of his movement. It's pretty impressive to know that his disciples know that. So he says that, you know, Prabhupada just, you know, he was not even looking at him, he was looking outside the window, and he says, there are so many shlokas, that's it. So Maharaj says that, no, he says, my head went down, I knew, my ego was fine. Prabhupada knew that I was kind of projecting, you know, how much I knew. It didn't come out externally, but he just sensed it. So he ignored it. He says, there are so many shlokas. So after reciting 5-6 shlokas, everything went out of the window. So this is where we can't fool others, you know, we may fool others, but we certainly can't fool Krishna. And definitely pure devotees also can lead us. So we have to really be in touch with the reality. And the reality is we know. We know where we are, and once we know the purpose, then our attempt should not be to justify or to show a perception. Our attempt should be doesn't matter where we are. I don't think we need to project or impress anyone. That is never the problem. And devotees are not impressed by that anyway. They just want the reality and they're trying to help. So it is all, we are in the same boat. So, in conclusion, we should be concerned only by, our response to a situation should be the way Indra responded, by surrendering to Krishna. And that surrender is really a surrender of a false ego. Ultimately, surrender means it may come out in we may surrender our money, we may surrender our time, but eventually surrendering, the root of it is, if we are able to surrender our false ego, or at least we attempt to do that, we start doing that and make it a goal, then everything else follows. Because then everything that we do, because then the identity is Krishna, and we are looking ourselves as whatever we have, it's only a matter of enhancing Krishna's reputation, not ours. So we'll end here, and any questions? I don't think we have any time for that, yes? India then. So, Granthra Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.